My guest today has done it all. He's founded businesses, he's bought businesses, he's sold businesses, he's invested. He's succeeded, and he'd be the first to tell you he's failed a few times as well. All that experience has given Zane Torrance, author of 17 Reasons Your Company Is Not Investment Grade and What to Do About It, a unique perspective on the entrepreneurial journey. If you are an entrepreneur looking to make your business investment ready and investment worthy, this episode is for you. He and I talk about acquisition strategies, finding your optionality, how to create enterprise value, how to determine if your company has the ingredients to create risk-adjusted future cash flows, and a whole lot more. Listen in as we walk through the 17 things you must consider as you are scaling your business. Welcome to the Integrate and Ignite podcast. Today, I've got Zane Torrance with us, who is going to talk all things growth and scaling and provide us some insights on the investment community when it comes to entrepreneurial organizations. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Lori, I'm pumped about being with you.
Oh, I tell you, I'm so excited. You have such a massive background when it comes to not only founding your own business, and owning it, but investing and selling along the way. I mean, just everything. And we're going to share lots of insights today with our audience about some lessons learned and this great book that you wrote called 17 Lessons or 17 Reasons Your Company Is Not Investment Grade and What to Do About It. So we're going to share all those insights with you today. Before we dive into that, tell us a little bit more about your journey and the gifts that you provide people as an entrepreneur.
Ah, thank you so much, Lori. I love stories. And now I'm a little bit older. And as you said, I've done a lot. But let me tell you, I failed a lot. And that's where the greatest lessons have been. I've been blessed to have a few big wins that kind of tied me over. But I started with IBM, and I am biased by my experiences. Okay. So I want to be honest.
Hey, my bias is fine.
Okay, good. I'm biased by my experiences, you know, where I've been, what I've seen, what I've done, and what I've learned.
That's called experience.
Okay. Yes. That's it. Yeah. So I'm not shy to talk about that from my perspective, but I started with a large corporation with IBM, straight out of college, worked with them for 12 years, had four different careers at IBM, which I loved. My last career, Lori, I worked for IBM Global Services, and there I ran a consulting practice in the Deep South. You can probably tell by the way I talk.
Just a little.
Yeah, I'm from Texas. I'm from Amarillo, Texas, in Montgomery, Alabama. But I spoke Southern. I ran a consulting practice, ended up inventing a product for one of my clients, Federal Express, which was in Memphis. IBM had an infopreneuring program then, and basically where with content and technology, they would let, you know, some of us write a business plan, and they ended up funding my company. So long story, it was great. So I still bleed blue. I'm very, very true to IBM because they were my funder. I started a company back in 1997, and 3 years into it, IBM funded me. We ended up getting venture capital. We also got private equity. And then 3 years into it, we were blessed enough to sell it to a publicly traded company out of Boston called Houghton Mifflin. So that was my first foray into entrepreneurism. I've always been a technical person at IBM. I was I was leading a consulting practice, but that was my first foray into business and then raising capital. After that, I started a VC model incubator. I thought, hey, this was fun. We were pretty good at this. Now I'm gonna be an investor and I'm gonna raise money. Lori, that wasn't as exciting of a journey. I started investing. Yeah, I started investing, and I'm not sure, you know, I might have been lucky on my first deal. I thought, oh, look at this. We did this. It's pretty easy, but learned so much. From 2001 to 2007, I funded some of my money and others' capital, a venture capital model incubator with small software companies and technology service businesses, basically to, you know, see if we could grow these and build some value. By God's grace, I had one that made it. The others were so difficult. I mean, it was so hard.
How many was one out of how many?
Yeah, I invested in six. Two of them didn't make it. three of them, we kind of, you know, they were halfway in, halfway out, and we were able to transition those and land the plane to some of our employees. They took it over, but we didn't make money, but we got money out of it. Right. One of them was a win. I had jumped down to become the CEO of that business, and we sold that to a publicly traded company out of India. And so I was so grateful. And I said, God, if you let me get out of this entrepreneur stuff, and entrepreneur, you know, means entre, enter, pre, before, neural, you think. I said, if you let me get out of this, I won't do this again. But it was wonderful.
And here you are. Here you are again.
Yeah. So, and now I'm a river guide. I'm a river guide for other entrepreneurs like me as an investment banker. We invest in companies and we help companies find their optionality. If they need growth capital, if they need debt, if they want a minority or majority recap, or if they say, you know what, we'd be better on a strategic buyer's platform. I help them now, from my perspective, navigate the options. And that's the reason I wrote this silly book, which a lot of people hate the title, but I wanted to help entrepreneurs like myself in my early days know, hey, make sure that you know what creates enterprise value. Make sure you know what investors and buyers really want, or you can get out there and build something and say, uh-oh, I spent all my time and energy not building lasting value. So that's what we do now as an investment bank. My partner and I was on his board, but 20 years ago, he started this bank. I moved over with him 16 years ago, and we built a little boutique bank. We have about 40 bankers and 12 support staff in Dallas, Texas, Birmingham, Alabama. And all I do, Lori, what I love to do is try to help entrepreneurs, founder-based entrepreneurs, figure out how to grow their business and meet their goals. That's it.
Well, and I had the luxury of interacting with one of your colleagues, Brian, and as a part of your book, each chapter walks you through these 17 things that you need insights on to better run your business, to scale your business, and to create more value at the end of the day. Before we talk more about that book, tell us more specifically about Founders Advisors. Now, you are one of the two partners, correct?
That is correct.
Two founders, rather.
Yes. We have a founder. I was on his board, then I joined him, and then we hired a president that actually is a better operator than either one of us. And now Wes is also a partner. So we have partners. And again, we're a broker dealer. So what we do, we're able to securitize private companies, go out to the financial markets, the institutional financial markets, and help those entrepreneurs get the capital solution that they need and desire.
Yeah, I love it. So, you know, all of this experience on the street led you also to realizing that you could create successful deals for your clients if you were able to take all these insights that you know inside and out and turn it into a business model for them to basically have a check and balance, which is when you took that and wrote the book.
100%. And it's so simple. I tell people, Lori, there's nothing new here, but here's the issue with me. I know more than I actually execute. After 36 years of marriage, I've been married 36 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's one of my greatest accomplishments. But I have a wonderful wife. But, you know, I know exactly how to be a great husband to my wife, Jamie. What's my problem? Why do I still fail sometimes? It's not because I need to read another marriage book or I need to go to counseling. I need to execute on the simple love languages of my wife.
Right.
And that's when I wrote this book. It's like, can we really just look at pattern recognition? What makes a valuable company? And let's focus on engineering that and spending our effort, our limited capital, our limited time. Let's focus on things that make a super valuable company. And here's what I love, Lori, and even like you and I were talking, even if you never want to raise capital, you never want to sell your business. Now, one day you'll exit one way or another. We're all going to exit.
Yeah.
But we might want to give it to our employees or do an ESOP or transition it to our family. Isn't it better to have an investment grade business that you own?
That's exactly right. And that's exactly right. Why aren't, what is the number one reason that precludes a company from being investment worthy?
Great, Great question. And all these 17 reasons is kind of ridiculous, but all of them relate. But here's the big deal. Your operating model does not create risk-adjusted future cash flow. You've got a business, but when you really look at it, and you said the word a minute ago, scale, it really fundamentally cannot scale to continue to create margin, operating cash, and grow that margin because you don't have the systems and processes in place. You don't have the right people. You don't have the right service offering or product market fit that you need. So basically, it all boils down to, does your company have the ingredients to create risk-adjusted future cash flows?
Yeah.
That's it. And every one of these reasons points to that, Lori.
Well, and it's something very, very important. And I think a lot of companies end up trying to get capital to, you know, to basically cover up a mess that they've created. Exactly. And that's never a good position to be in. So many of these fundamental, but there's tried and true approaches to making sure that you are investment grade. And it's just plain better way to run your business too. You know, the KPIs, the OKRs, the finance side of it, you know, and the marketing side of it from an awareness standpoint is very, very important. So when you are beginning to invest or when you are beginning to consult with people,
right,
what is typically the number one worry that they have about knowing whether or not they can or cannot achieve investment grade?
Yeah, and this is very interesting because a lot of people at my life stage, you know, they get a little gray hair. I'm 57 years old.
Or you color it.
Yeah, you could color. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's good. That makes me feel better. But, you know, they're starting to think about their legacy. You know, right. I built this company. I've got something special. They're thinking about their people. I mean, it's amazing. You know, most owners really, really care about their people because they know how they got there if you have a successful business. So they start thinking, how am I going to position my business and transition it while also being super mindful of my team, my employees? And also for most of us entrepreneurs, I think the latest number is about 90% of most business owners' wealth of private companies is tied up in their business.
Right.
Because we built a business. So you've got all this money that's not liquid. And right. So really their concern is, how do I transition the business to the right people? Also financially make sure, you know, I'm okay, but then make sure my team's okay as well. That's the reason most people come to us, Lori. And that's when we start looking and saying, okay, let's really see how you would be valued in the market. A lot of people get valuations that are financial valuations. Their accountant might say, okay, your EBITDA is 2 million, your trailing 12 months EBITDA is 2 million. In your industry, that trades for about 8 or 9 times, you know, last 12 months EBITDA. So you're worth $18 million. That's not what we do, because there's right. So many other factors that can give you a huge bandwidth of what you're worth. So most of the time it's transition planning that brings people to us.
Yeah, I love that. And you know, at least the question in their own mind of where am I going to take this thing? And, you know, and how can I either increase the health of the organization, maintain it, or scale, as we've talked a lot about. We are going to get into the not all the 17 reasons. Sure. We are definitely going to get there in a minute. But as you were talking, you know, all too often, and we were right outside of IBM in Boulder County, by the way. So a technology incubator is very, I mean, this whole, people refer to Boulder County as the Silicon Valley of the East, by the way. And because there's so much technology business in this area, it's always about ARR. What's ARR? Yeah, so on and so forth. But we were talking in the pre-show discussion about, you know, we're a service organization.
Sure.
And ARR is a little bit more difficult. Yes, we have reoccurring revenue when it comes to our ongoing contracts. And, sure. You know, what does that retention look like? You know, all those sort of questions that you ask in the survey. But it's not as saleable, seemingly. Lay out the landscape for us right now from an industry standpoint around the sorts of businesses that are saleable and what, you know, what these entrepreneurs need to be considering.
Okay, perfect. And I'll first start with that. One of my favorite topics is the different kinds of revenue, Lori. As you mentioned, no matter what type of industry you're in, there's a continuum of revenue. And what I say is not all revenue is created equally. That's the reason people come to me in the tech world and say, hey, what am I going to trade as a multiple of ARR, a multiple of revenue, a multiple of EBITDA, multiple of gross margin? That's not the right question. What are my different income streams on my income statement going to trade for? And then they're going to average. So in every industry, you could have some project work, right? In a construction company, in a project base, in your industry, you might do some consulting around brand. That is project work that happens one time. There's a certain multiple on that based on your industry. Then you move down the continuum toward really, really good revenue. You have reoccurring revenue. Mm-hmm. I used to think reoccurring and recurring were the same word. They're not. They're worth a lot. Recurring is worth a lot more money. Reoccurring happens again. You just don't really know when. So if you look back at your data with all your clients, you probably have additional revenue, additional projects, new things. It just might not be on a quarterly basis that they're paying you, a monthly basis, an annual contract. So that's reoccurring revenue. And if your data can show that, that could trade in your business let's say 8 or 9 times EBITDA. One time project revenue might trade for 4 times EBITDA. Now, if you get into this, and this is what we call it in your space, a services business, CAS, not SaaS, software as a service, but consulting as a service, where you get your client on a contract, say, listen, I need you constantly looking at my messaging, constantly looking at my content. And I want to pay you $1,000 a month to do all this stuff and really outsource my marketing branding to a specialist. If that's all you do, we're a bank. And I will pay you $1,000 a month to do that. Guess what? That trades just like a software company trades. Mm-hmm. And so every business, no matter what industry you're in, can have those three types of revenue. Now, if I'm a contractor building houses, most of that is one time. But if I can show that I'm building more and more houses in a certain demographic for a certain group of people, for a certain architectural firm that's referring me those people, then I can move into that neighborhood of higher multiples. So I would say the number one thing that entrepreneurs need to do, and it's my first reason, is really look at your revenue stream, and the more predictable you can make that, the more valuable your company is.
Well, and we, and having KPIs around it. So we have a specific goal for our reoccurring revenue, which is 85%. So it's ongoing contracts monthly. You know, we typically take the fee, amortize it over 12 months. There's their fee. And then the project work. And sometimes we do the project work because we might want to put, you know, we want to get our foot into a new industry or it's something really exciting or something like that. That really helps. But the important thing is the KPI around it. Our number is 85%. We want 85%. Yeah, we want 85% of, and we measure that year over year over year. Where are our what is our project work to reoccurring revenue?
I love it. Hey Lori, there's something, sorry, I want to say something else. You brought a huge point. Never think that all project revenue is bad, because so much of project revenue tees up reoccurring and recurring
it
revenue.
It does. That's it exactly tees it up. Right.
So you go in there, you do the study, say, hey, I'll do a $10,000 discovery session. It's going to be valuable to you. I'm going to give you a report. But guess what? That becomes your recommendation, your proposal for a recurring reason that they need you in there. So I'm not poo-pooing all one-time revenue. Just make sure you know its relationship to recur.
Yeah, I think that's great. I love how you differentiate that. And you don't hear it too often, which again is one of the big values. Everyone needs to go and buy your book, because there's so many incredible nuggets in here about really the infrastructure behind setting up a very, very successful business and having those KPIs in place. Okay, so let's walk through some, let's get back to the industries.
Okay,
so
yes.
You focus in a lot of different industries from an investment banking standpoint, but your book covers any possible industry, across the board. So it's industry agnostic. So this book, what you talk about here, these 17 reasons are valuable to anyone in business today.
100%. You're gonna, if you have an institutional investor, they're gonna use these 17 things. Again, they're not original, as a rubric to judge you. Just like if you were a gymnast or a diver, you're judged by a group of judges that say, what is your creativity, degree of difficulty? I'm telling you, Lori, these 17 things are, they're gonna grade you very seriously. If you're a contractor, if you have hamburger chains, or if you're a digital marketing agency or a SaaS provider, they're gonna rate you. Now, it's gonna be very different what your ultimate valuation is going to be, right? Because different industries kind of trade different ways, but they trade different ways because of these 17 things.
Right.
Because if you're going to trade on a 10 times ARR, I promise you, your risk adjusted future cash flow is going up and to the right, and it looks beautiful. So
great it really question. Does. So walk us through, there's categories within the 17 different strategic levers, if you will. So walk us through the categories, and then we're going to go back and talk through each one.
Okay, great. And these relationships and these things have to do with people and with processes, basically. Each one of them have to do that. And there's only one that's really not a reason, but I put it in there. And that was about if you don't exit appropriately. So number 17 is, don't just have somebody knock on your door and say, hey, I want to invest in your company or buy your company, and say, okay, let's talk about it. Just like if somebody knocked on the door of your house, you can say, wait a second, I need to have some comps and precedents, right? So that's number 17. The other ones are about people and processes and the way your unit economic model works. So those other 17, the key ones are about how you need to set up your company, and you said it, to have KPIs to monitor your vital signs. Mm-hmm. What are your vital signs in a business? They're your key processes. The way you make money, the way you spend money, who is your ideal customer, what is your product or service market fit? So all these processes that help you deliver your product or service to where clients go, wow. And that ends up giving you pricing power, barriers to entry, and it allows you to create a platform where you can have margin expansion. And so I know I'm going in all these categories, and we'll list a few of these, but one of the main things that these point to, Lori, and if I could look at one thing in any business, and we have a industry sector specialist in our bank in about 23 industries. Wow. If you're not in that sector with us, you know, we'd recommend you to a bank that focuses on it. But the thing I would look at that all these 16 of the 17 reasons point to is gross margin.
Right.
If you can have a higher gross margin than other marketing agencies, digital marketing agencies, that tells me that you have a competitive advantage.
Right.
And competitive advantage is what's valuable. Because if you can sell your product or service at the same price as your competitors and still and create that product or service because you have intellectual property, you have technology at a lower cost, that means you have a higher gross margin. Or if it costs you the same amount to deliver your product or service, but you can price it for more than your competitors, it means your people are better, you're more efficient, you got better references, something's happening. So all these 17 reasons focus on that. And if you want me to land on a couple of these, I will, but I wanted to categorize a little bit about what I'm looking for in the relationship of these things.
Well, and we'll land on a few here in a minute. You talk about process, and we've worked with over 1,200 entrepreneurial organizations in the last 43 years. Process grows with time. They don't have a lot of process out of the chute, especially, they might have an engineering process that is product-based, but they don't have the finance down yet. They don't have the people piece down yet. They don't have a lot of those things. And we found ourselves in situations where companies just were not ready for marketing because the process wasn't in place to be able to back it up. And I even, 2 weeks ago, I had a discussion with a really great brand, and I told them that they should just save their money for 6 months or 9 months. And then we could help them get to where they wanted to go, because they've just underfunded the marketing need at this stage. And it's far better for us to take all that money and go, into a, 2 or 3 month campaign than it is to just do something that's not going to work for them. And so, you know, and that was a candid discussion, you know, that ultimately they were disappointed, but they really appreciated because that's where the proof, you know, in the pudding was, you know, what you have just is not going to work. So from a process standpoint, how often are you running into companies that just don't have what it takes yet because the process is not there, or it's not refined, or dare I say it's not mature?
Exactly. A lot. Yeah. A lot. And let's take a couple of processes. You're very familiar, because it's your business, of marketing, you know, and how that paves the way for sales and how you get your qualified leads, your monthly qualified leads. How do you convert those in your sales model? We see over and over, Lori, that a lot of small and medium business clients, and most of our clients, let me give you the size, are between about 25 million in enterprise value and 150 million. That's our size. So typically, you know, 50 employees to 400 employees. So I'm not talking about one Subway sandwich shop, right?
Right.
I'm talking about an SMB business. And by the way, what do franchises typically have? Why do you buy a franchise? For proven
processes. The infrastructure is there. Yeah.
It's there. They say, please, please, please run the playbook. If you're going to buy a Chick-fil-A, well, you can't buy a Chick-fil-A, a McDonald's, please, please, please don't say, well, I think I can create a better fry. No, they give you the equipment, that kind of ingredients, how long to push. You push the button, it immediately pulls out the fries for you now. So processes, most businesses struggle with this, and it's a maturity cycle. You don't immediately grow into a mature business. But what you want to do, Lori, is study your industry, best practices. And you can collapse time frames if you study your publicly traded cohort. But, you know, publicly traded companies have better processes than small businesses.
Yeah.
Study it, read, look for playbooks, even private equity groups that own companies in your space. You can collapse them. But sales and marketing is a place most people, some of them don't even have a CRM. They don't even know how to profile their leads to know what's been time. They don't have a content marketing strategy. So I don't think I'm going to write an article this month. Well, how about a content calendar, right? So sales and marketing is ad hoc most of the time in these small businesses. Mm-hmm. Now, guess what buyers see the best uplift in? What if we had marketing for this awesome product or service? We could have sales and marketing processes that could double their sales immediately.
The awareness that they're buying.
The awareness that they're trying to get there.
The brand health.
Bingo. Yeah. Secondly, financial processes. They are weak. Guess what? The first thing that an institutional buyer that understands your industry, is very mature, have typically built companies over and over in your space. One of the first things they do when they buy a company is they upgrade the financial talent. Okay. They might add a CFO. If you have a controller, most of the time small businesses overtitle their financial people. So I'll say, oh, I've got a controller. I'll come and say, no, you really have a bookkeeper. They go, oh, shoot, I thought I had it. Or, okay. Or they say, I have a CFO, but we really look at, no, you have a controller. So financial processes are typically really, really soft. And that costs you a lot of money if you're looking at raising capital or selling a piece or all of your business.
Right.
Not to have GAAP accounting. Most clients, a lot of them have cash-based accounting. Any buyer is going to look at you, like we were talking pre-show, they're going to want to map and match your expenses in a time period to your revenue.
And even if you are a service organization, at least account GAAP and then convert to cash based on, you know, at the end of the year, whatever it is. Well,
exactly.
That wouldn't apply just to service organization, but that is where you get the clear picture.
Exactly.
I mean, that is, you know, it's, you're talking, and I have not talked about this in a long time on this show, but you talk about process. One of the best books out there on process is The E-Myth. Right?
Hey, Michael Gerber.
Yeah, he's incredible.
I read that book 24 years ago. I called him. I found him and called him. He picked up the phone and talked to me, Lori, for 35 minutes.
I love
that. That is still one of my go-to books that you have to read if you're an entrepreneur.
It is. And it really, it instills the importance of a process. And
You brought up McDonald's, you brought up franchise. I think that is a way for a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs who may not be an engineer or who may not be strategic and have a creative idea. They want to do their own thing ultimately to get into business. But the unique thing about those brands is that they're constantly reinventing process. So you walk into a McDonald's today versus the McDonald's 10 years ago, and it is a completely different organization. And so we, you know, we've been in business 42 years, 43 years. We've stood the test of time because we've reinvented our process and pivoted time and time and time again. The other point I want to make about, a CFO, a controller, a bookkeeper, associations have some of the best financial management modeling for very vertical industries out there. I'm a member of AMI. The reason I scored so high when I took the 17 Reasons test with Brian was because of the processes that I've had in place for the last, 30 years since I joined AMI, that measure, the cash flow, that measure, the AGI versus EBITDA versus operational costs. And we measure to these percentages week over week over week all year round. And that's how you grow. That's how you position yourself for ultimately a sale or an acquisition, downstream. But people don't have that. They don't think about it.
They don't think about it. And Laura, I've got to double click on what you just said. Associations, unbelievable. And as a part of that, peer groups, masterminds. Right. If you can get with other people, Vistage, you can get also with other people in your industry, even around the country, because you don't want to get with your competitors in your city, and you talk about these KPIs, these measurements, it makes you better. What I always say is, one of my mentors, John Maxwell, says, show me your friends and I'll show you your future.
Right.
Whoever you have. So find people that are excellent in your industry at those KPIs, at those models, those processes, hang around them, and guess what will happen? Just like my tennis game gets better when I play better people, it gets worse when I play people that aren't very good.
Yeah.
Same thing in business. So that's a wonderful way to test your processes and making sure that you're improving every day.
I was just talking to one of my daughter's friends about this over the weekend, and it's track season, and he keeps on getting put into the second heat. And he keeps on winning in a big, big way. And I said to him the other day, can you imagine how well you'd be doing if you were in that first heat? Because you're running against the faster kids, and he's just gonna be faster. That's just, exactly Bingo. What's gonna happen. And I love that. So we went through some of the categories: marketing spend, customers, product fit, finance, so on and so forth. Where do you see most marketing failing when it comes to a great valuation
for a absolutely. Business? They do not have the data to show attribution. Where did the lead come from? Okay. Right. Where did it come from? Did it come from my book? Did it come from a speaking engagement? Did it come from a piece of content? Now, obviously, it could come from all of that, but where does it come from? And then how does that lead the data? In God we trust, all others bring data. How does that lead go through my sales funnel to produce a customer and then a referral? If you can't show that, if it's like, I don't know, it just kind of, I wake up every morning, there's some leads, we go, we make a sales call. If you can't show how many of your demos, if you're in software, convert to a sale, private equity and financial buyers, they say, this person's confused. Right. They don't like to invest where there's not data to say, if we do more of this, we're going to get more top of the funnel leads, and they're going to watch that lead all the way through the funnel. If you have an ad hoc process, Lori, it ain't good. And can I tell you really where I see the problem? Because you're looking at a guy that experienced this. I thought I was the best business developer, and I thought I was unbelievable in my business. Mm-hmm. Guess what? When we went and people started looking at my first company, we took a huge deduction cut on our valuation because they looked at me as the sales system.
Yeah.
How am I going to scale my company? I needed to say my sales are a system with people working that, not me. It doesn't depend on me going and presenting to the school board to sell my educational software. Because if it does, guess what? My company's not worth anything. Because mm-hmm. the second they pay me $30 million, I might not be as interested to get on a plane to go sell, right? So it is sales and marketing process around the sales funnel that most companies are like, huh, I don't really know how that works.
That can make a lot of sense for, you know, the SaaS companies, e-commerce, you know, that sort of stuff. What about a company that 90% of their business is referral? How do you measure that?
Oh, good point. Because you're talking about my company that I work with today and you. Number one, referral is awesome because that's somebody saying, I believe in this. Either I was a user of it or I've seen people use the product and they love it. I get all my business from referrals. And so that is awesome. But you still got to codify that.
Right.
Who are the referrals? I get referrals from three major wealth management groups in the United States of America. They have clients that own businesses. They want to unlock some liquidity. How many did I get last month? Hmm. How did those work when I got them? How many
close did I get ratio?
Yes. Yeah. How many did I get to present? How many did I get to give me their data for me to look at their blood and give them a proposal? How many did I close? How many, you know, and I track every one of those things to say, wow, these are my referral sources and they're important. So you still got to track it, even if that's your
application. You do. Yeah, I built this system, probably 7 or 8 years ago, that I backed in our win rate. I backed in the referrals. We took a look at referrals, people just picking up the phone and calling us, brand awareness, and marketing, just general, you know, SEM marketing. And we took a look at the leads that we get through all of those. And then what we did is we took a look at the amount, the revenue goal for the year, and the reoccurring revenue that we had, the amount of attrition we would have, and what the new number was for the bucket. So what we needed to bring in that year for the, then we backed in our win ratio. And so we then knew that if our win ratio is about 50%, that we needed to bring in 20 businesses that had a value of X in order to bring in 10 of them to meet the financial goal. And that is, I mean, that's just, you know, inquisitive minds, right? That's just thinking, okay, wait, if I do have to codify this, how are we going to do it? How are we going to systematize it? And then what kind of process do we have? People, I mean, that is where, as a service organization, it's easy to say, wait, it's all referral. I don't need marketing. I don't need the system. Here's exactly why you do need it.
Exactly. And what you just demonstrated to me, Lori, as a, you know, institutional investor, is that you could scale.
Yeah.
What if we moved you to Atlanta, Georgia, the business said, hey, let's move. Let's put one of our top consultants in Atlanta or Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, Austin, Texas, some of the hottest markets. Could you scale there? It would be the same model that you've done, you know, in the Boulder area. So that's exactly, you just built a unit economic model. Also, you can look at all those pieces of your funnel, say, what if we could start training our people, doing certain things to become more effective, where our conversion rate would go from 50 to 58%. What does that mean to our model? And we build, you know, big spreadsheets around that. Down south, we call them BASS, B-A-S-S, a big ass spreadsheet.
I love it.
Yeah, but yeah, you're on it. So that's another process. Every process has to have data. It has to be measured because, as Deming said, whatever gets measured gets improved. And so wonderful on that. And Lori, you hinted on this a minute ago. I got to give another process. We talked about financial processes, marketing, sales processes, people processes.
Yeah. So important today, isn't it?
Oh, if I could put one thing on a billboard at my age with a lot of companies, I mean, I probably had 60 or 70 companies that I owned or invested in and was on the board of. If I could put one thing on a billboard, I mean, so it's got to be short. I would put this: exceptional people create exceptional results.
Yeah, I agree.
It is all about, what is your process to locate talent, attract talent, onboard talent, retain talent, and then lovingly get the wrong talent off the bus fast. because that's the only loving thing to do. If they don't fit, they know they don't fit. They know other people are looking at them like, man, I wish they were carrying their weight. So that is the key, whether you have a product company or a service company. I tell my clients, be good to my people, because I will fire you if you abuse my people. You know why? Yeah. I deliver my gold standard service through people. When I'm the little bitty bank, my partner and I could deliver the service, right? Mm-hmm. We can't now. So be good to my people, because that's how I deliver my gold standard service delivery to you. It is people. And then how do you create a culture with those people? How do you understand what motivates them? And people say, and I got to be honest, Lori, at my age, I grew up in a little tough environment that was like, you know, at IBM, you don't make your quota, you're out, right?
Yeah.
It's changed a little bit. These younger folks, they're scary bright. They're smarter than we ever were, super talented, but it's not all about the money to them. Their motivations are different.
Community. And I think
community and doing quarterly conversations with your A-plus players,
right,
and really understanding what they're after, what they're looking for. Most of them, you know what they're looking for? Growth.
Right.
Being in an environment where they can be all they can be, as the Army says. So anyway, that's a process that I'm really focused on in this later stage of my career.
I love it so much. And one thing that we've been doing with a lot of our brands is developing a vivid vision. So one of the main reasons people leave businesses is because they don't know where the company's going.
That's
which
right.
Which is why communication is so important, why those quarterlies or those, you know, those monthly meetings are so important. But a vivid vision, you know, brings that individual into the story that you're telling, as though they're a part of it 3 years downstream, discussing what has been accomplished.
Yes.
And that is, I mean, and it shows the sophistication of the leader as well. You know, I'm not just working day to day to day here. I'm working toward this is what we will accomplish 3 years downstream.
Absolutely. And Lori, I don't mean to sell your type of business, right? What you do, but marketing and branding is focused on clients and prospects. It's also focused on talent.
How do you
tell your story well
to
attract A players that say, I like that. I want a shared fate with that company because I appreciate their values and their vision.
Of the five or six categories that you talked about that you measure against in the quiz, or it's not a test, it's a survey.
It's a survey.
Where do you see most companies failing is a strong word, but I guess falling down on with the people side of it.
With the people side. Okay. Cause there's one that people all miss in Vistage. We've done over 1,000 of these with CEOs like yourself in Vistage. And I'll see what's going on the people side. Here's the deal. They don't force rank their employees. And you go, what? Every symphony, every chorus, they force rank. This is first chair, second chair. This is top 10 or second. Every athletic team, do they just say, we've got four quarterbacks and whoever we flip a coin? No, they have QB1, QB2, QB3. Most entrepreneurs are uncomfortable force ranking their talent. Why do you need to do that? Every investor or buyer that ever comes to you, Lori, they're going to ask you. You know your people, but who can we not lose? So they can do stay bonuses and compensation and grow. And we're uncomfortable doing that. The number one place people fall down is they don't force rank. And therefore, guess what? My buddy Patrick Lencioni, I know him. Yeah. He doesn't know me. I know him. I've eaten dinner with him. I know him, but he wouldn't remember me. He says that we spend more time typically with our B minus and C players. They take more energy.
Yeah.
And I don't want to talk about kids. You know, I've got kids. Guess what? I spent more time with certain kids than others, right? But how does the A players feel? We have to be very honest that it's about them and we need to talk to them. So that's where they fall down. They don't force rank. They don't know how to love their top player. They don't know the partners and spouses of their A players, what their favorite restaurant is, what their favorite wine is, what their favorite candy bar is. If you can serve your A players, they will die for you. Now, you got to show them how they can share in the vision, how they can one day maybe get equity. But that's the number one place that I see them falling down.
Yeah, I love that. And it's so true. And, you know, I think we get so busy running the business that we forget to take care of, you know, our own team as well. I mean, it's a juggling act. There's no doubt about it.
It's hard.
Okay. So you were going to go here when I asked the question. So what is the main area that most companies with this whole system, or should I say process, with this whole process, where do they fall short?
Okay. And I'm so glad I made you ask me this question, but I've just gotten the data back for most of the Vistage deals we do with CEOs and people in Vistage. Come on, you CEOs are intellectually curious. You're growing faster. You're doing great stuff. Let me tell you, in these CEOs, what the data is showing. The against the cohort, the weakest of these 17 it deals is growth. Hmm. Growth. And you know why? We're not holding each other accountable.
Right.
Growth is hard. And I say, you know what? My partner and I, we've already done fine. We've made money. We don't have to grow. We just kind of want to be a lifestyle company. Guess what? Talent doesn't want to work for a lifestyle company. And we give ourselves an excuse. Well, that's the reason we're not growing at 40%. And we're not growing as fast as our industry or as our competitors. So the weakest area across these 17 things with the people, now that we have actual data coming in, is we don't hold ourselves to an aggressive growth rate. Because you know what? Growth is hard.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to go work out every day. If I don't break a sweat, you don't grow, and we get lazy and we play like, as my grandmother said, we plight that we're doing okay, when really our foot's not on the accelerator. And people say, wait a second, Zane, it's not all about growth, is it? No, it's about healthy growth, but it's the combination of your profitability growth and your revenue growth. It's not just revenue growth at all costs. It's not just profit, and then we're not going to grow. We're going to fire everybody. We're not going to create new products. Any kind of growth, Lori, destroys your income statement, because you have to hire people. You have to market. You have to say, man, I'm investing for the future. It's the balance between your revenue growth and your EBITDA growth that you want to balance. And guess what? Every industry has what we call the rule of 40 to let you know the relationship. You add your EBITDA margin plus your annual growth rate, your cumulative annual growth rate. And if you need to be a certain number to be healthy, most owners, I don't really want to focus on that because it's too hard.
Well, and I think a lot of times we see this all the time where they want it all. They want the lifestyle. So they still want to be, you know, bringing in, you know, the extra $200,000-$400,000, you know, to their individual line each month. And they're not investing where they need to. And we've got another situation we're probably going to walk away from, that this company wants to scale, but they don't have the marketing dollar. They do have the marketing dollars needed to scale. They're not willing to take it away from the personal P&L. And that's a huge issue. And you know, and which is fine. You know, if that's the way you want to manage your business, fine. But we can't help you get to where
you can't help them.
We can't.
And Lori, you said it. If I own 100% of the business, I can do whatever I want to do, right?
Yeah.
But here's the deal. Here's the deal. That is called a lifestyle company.
It is.
That is not a growth equity.
It is.
If you have people that work for you that one day you want to give options, or you have an ESOP, or you have any kind of profit sharing, it is not fair to be a lifestyle company. And guess what? Really good talent, they don't want to work for a lifestyle company that the owners just, they want to work for a company that wants to grow, that wants to conquer, that wants to do acquisitions, mm-hmm. that wants to be all they can be, so they'll have more opportunities. So I'm going to tell you,
I totally agree.
Force yourself to do what it takes to grow at least as fast as your industry, maybe a little faster in your competitors.
Well, I tell you, you've shared so many incredible insights today. Thank you for that. What is the best way for people to be able to reach out to you? And actually, you can take the test, the quiz online.
Absolutely. And it's something that we want to give you. Just foundersib as an investment bank.com, www.foundersib.com. And I'm all over there. We have ways to take the assessment. And we love serving entrepreneurs with content. And Lori, as I told you, we have sector coverage content for many of the industries we talked about earlier, your industries and others. So any way we can do that through our basic website, we have a ton of content out there.
Well, I tell you, you're incredible, Zane. Thank you so much for your insights today. You've been a gift. Your wisdom is incredible. And we look forward to watching you grow your business as well over the next many, many years. Thank you so much for your appearance on the Integrate and Ignite podcast.
Lori, thank you. It was my pleasure.
This episode is complete. Head over to avasetcommunications.com for more ways to scale and grow your business. And be sure to tune in regularly for insights and motivation with host Lori Jones and her guests on the Integrate and Ignite Marketing Podcast.